This is Radio Freethinker, episode 101 on Radio...
Welcome to the future. Geek Pop 3. Yeah. Better find them a nice soft place to land. Cause they sound high. They're coming down. Find them a nice soft place to land, right? Pseudoscientists. Pseudo mystics. Come on now. Pseudo psychics. Come on now. It's all pseudo. Come on now. It's all pseudo. Come on now. It's all pseudo. Come on now. I want tomorrow to be better than yesterday. That's why I'm all about technology. So if you say slow it down, I'ma say fast forward. And if you want the benefits, but not the process, then you're hypocrites. Everybody's wish list is for new toys and tools and better medicines. And you can have this wish, just ask the methodological naturalists. And if your spouse gets sick, consult professionals, never know this is. Deep down you all know this, Jay-Z thinks I had to borrow this. To make sure tomorrow is filled with a bit less moronic shit.
Whatever scientists can discover, you want that. When it's justice and life and death, you want facts. When you feel threatened by science, it's all bad. And you can't bring the future back. Mysticism and pseudoscience, we are facts.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is episode 101.
On CITR 101.9, which was what I was supposed to say at the intro, but... Well, 101, it's a complicated number.
Well, there's a 1 and a 0 and a 1. I mean, that's tough. That is a hard thing to say.
So anyway, who are you?
Well, I'm actually Ethan. You know me as the free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver. But who are you?
Well, I'm Don, political philosopher and person who screws up. Boy, this is twice. Political science and philosopher who can't seem to say the things right. Oh. But let's move on quickly before we notice that I said anything wrong. And Ethan, I know you're going to ask me what was new this week.
I'm going to ask you what's new this week.
Well, you know, I was watching, listening to the SGU, not Stargate, not Stargate Universe, but the Skeptic Guide to the Universe. And they had a little segment on there about a recent discovery that I'd heard about and we were going to do on the show, but they've already done it, so I'm going to probably skip over it for this week, about a new finding that dinosaur bones have been found after the KT event. The KT event is the event where the big asteroid came down and supposedly killed all the dinosaurs. And I've mentioned on this episode before, and anyone who's talked to me, you know, over coffee or whatever, that I've never quite believed that all the dinosaurs could have died in this event, or at least why they all died, but birds and salamanders and alligators survived, and it doesn't explain why a lot of the marine animals die too, who weren't even dinosaurs, they were actually lizards. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was always, but apparently this new finding says, well, maybe a bunch of them did survive, not most of them, just a few, so that there was sort of a plurality of them that had made it through, and the dinosaurs were just on the way out anyhow, and this was just another nail in their coffin.
Well, I mean, I remember that episode, too, and they were sort of saying that even within the community of archaeology and anthropology, it's a raging controversy. It seems like everything that's in the community of anthropology and archaeology is a raging controversy these days.
Well, they had pointed out, too, that most of the paleontologists are convinced that dinosaurs had lived a little bit after that, and this particular radiometric dating method gives them to about 700,000 years after the event. But most geologists are convinced, no, there's a line in the sand, literally, if you ever look at any of the geologists, it's literally this black line.
Right, right.
But see, controversy is good. It's what keeps science going. Of course, some controversy is bad, and there's like beating a dead horse. The science is done, the story is over, the fat lady has sung. And on that note, is there anything new in the controversy about homeopathy?
Well, you know, it's funny that you should bring that up because we weren't planning on this before the show or anything. But I was going to mention there's this thing called 2012 or 1023. There is that thing,
it's
too.
It's contagious.
Yeah. So you guys all remember 1023 from last year was an overdose by some skeptics in the UK in front of a well-known pharmaceutical chain that was selling homeopathy. Well, this year...
When you say overdose, sorry, I just want our people to know you didn't go out there with cyanide or sleeping pills and try and kill yourselves, did you?
Well, not cyanide. There was arsenic, but Yeah, well, see, what they did is they took homeopathic pills and they took the whole bottles, the whole containers of them, essentially overdosing. Now, people might say, well, isn't that really dangerous? And, well, actually, it's not, because the process that homeopaths go through to make their product, unfortunately for people who take it, takes away all the active ingredient. So you're left with literally nothing but water and, actually, in our case, sugar pills, because the water is put on the sugar pills and then evaporated. But anyway, this 1023 campaign has gone worldwide. And this past weekend, skeptics in Vancouver participated. We got over to the Vancouver Art Gallery. We set up a table. We did an overdose. We also did a live dilution, the whole shebang. We put the droplets in the thing. We shook it the right way and succussed it against the leather-bound Bible. We did it like the necessary five times for each one. We did it all the way up to 30C, right, and then took it. Nothing happened. It was a fun protest. People came and watched us. There was a few news people who came to film us, and it looked pretty good. A few people in the audience actually were fans of homeopathy and wanted to debate it with us, so we had some of our friends out in the audience handing out flyers and explaining what homeopathy is. It was really cool. And then I also learned that James Randi has offered his $1 million prize to any homeopath who can prove that homeopathy works.
Wow.
So, I mean, there you go. If you're a homeopath and you know it works, you got $1 million coming to you.
Provided you can prove it within the bounds of scientific evidence.
That's right.
Which, of course, is always where the catch is. In fact, I love homeopathy. We should do a little bit more about this at one point, about how it's like magic upon magic upon magic. Because, like, it's so wrong on many, 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 many different levels. But that may be wrong, but some people are kind of getting it right.
Really?
Recently, Bill Gates called out anti-vaxxers on CNN. Now, I have to thank one of our loyal listeners in Ontario for bringing this to my attention. Bill Gates, as many of us may know, is one of the richest people in the world, founded Microsoft, and is now one of the biggest philanthropic donors through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which donates millions and millions and millions of dollars every year to those people in need, emphasizing a lot on healthcare, vaccination, that sort of thing. On the interview on CNN, he was asked by Dr. Sanjay Rupta that, and I quote, "There's been a lot of scrutiny of vaccines recently, specifically childhood vaccines. There's been a lot of news about if there's a connection between them and autism. For example, what do you make of all that? Dr. Wakefield wrote a paper about this in The Lancet in 1998, saying that he thought there was a connection. And there were lower rates over the period of time resulting from this in Britain and then in the United States. What are your thoughts?" And Bill Gates came out and he says, "Well, Dr. Wakefield has shown to have been an absolute fraudulent data. He had financial interest in a lawsuit and he created a fake paper. And the journal, sadly, my editorial, allowed it to run. All of the studies that were done showed no connection whatsoever again and again and again. So it's an absolute lie that there have been thousands of kids hurt by this. Because the mothers who have heard this lie, many of them don't have their kids vaccinated and are dead today because of it. And so many people who have gone and engaged in these anti-vaccination efforts, you know, they've killed kids. It's a very sad thing because vaccination is important." Right? He goes on later to think, you know, because, you know, some people will say, well, you know, there's a difference of opinion about whether Western medicine's best or natural medicine. And he says, "I don't think there's any philosophy that suggests having polio is a good thing."
That's well said.
Yeah. There's another thing, too. And I mean, Bill Gates, among others, sometimes gets slammed because he's rich. And we don't like, well, people on the left don't like rich people. But there are one or two good ones out there, although, you know, he's trying to give money away. He makes an interesting point, too, that plays partly into this. He said, "Why should rich kids who barely get these diseases and almost never die, why should they get the vaccines when poor kids who actually do die from these don't get these things? There's unbelievable inequality with regards to access." Now, this is the idea that vaccinations are good, and a lot of third world countries, especially amongst religious type people, are slamming it. For example, the efforts to eliminate polio was severely retarded by Muslim clerics in places like Nigeria because they thought it was a Western plot. He goes on to say, there was a survey recently that showed that over half the kids in Africa, because of infectious diseases, have IQs of 80 or lower. There's cerebellum malaria, that's malnutrition, and their brains just don't fully develop. And if we want to have, you know, stable nations over there, we've got to fight these things, and one of the best ways to do that is through vaccinations. And he says, ultimately, there are 2 million people who would have died from something like smallpox, which was cured by vaccination, who are alive today, and should say, thanks, vaccinations.
Yeah,
I just thought that was a very good speech from someone who you wouldn't think would care.
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, people, I think, give Bill Gates, and perhaps because of all the problems that Microsoft has, a bad rap. But again, I mean, he's kind of a crusader for science-based medicine, especially, you know, HIV, AIDS prevention, malaria, these sort of things. So, I mean, if you don't like his software and the company, fine enough. But, I mean, at least the guy is trying to do some good in the world.
You know, and I don't know whether I'm really annoyed at the CNN's Dr. Sanjay Gupta for presenting Mr. Wakefield, I don't think he longer deserves the title doctor.
No.
He did this report, it was in the Lancet. I don't know whether that was bad reporting by just accepting it or whether it was a setup for Bill Gates to slam him down. But
hard to say.
Yeah.
Those type of things. But speaking of cool science.
Well, you know, and again, I always worry about how reporters do with science. Now, apparently, there's a new invisibility scheme out there. Now,
this is
the subtitle to an article in one of the science mags, which I have the link to on our webpage, but I forgot to put it in my notes. Sorry. It says, scientists are a step closer to creating a Star Trek-style cloaking device that are making an object visible. After making a visible object to the naked eye disappear for the first time. So they've got a cloaking device out there. Woo! We've heard a lot about this over the last couple of years, about, you know, this whole invisibility cloak idea. Notably, always around the time when a Harry Potter movie is about to be released.
It was always like that cloak of invisibility thing.
Yeah, that's curious. But anyhow, now, traditionally, when we've heard these stories beforehand, these cloaks are made out of what they call metamaterial. Now, these are artificial materials that have been specially engineered to have certain properties, and they only really seem to work on very specific wavelengths and on microscopic objects. You can't really see them. Well, two scientific groups, one in University of Birmingham and one at MIT, have accomplished something much better. The British team announced this month that they managed to cloak a paperclip. Okay, you're saying, ooh, a paperclip. But, I mean, at least you can see a paperclip. It's actually a real-world object.
Sure.
And it's never been done before. And they didn't use a high-tech material. They used calcite. Now, calcite is a crystalline form of calcium carbonate, and that's the stuff of seashells, which is, you know, quite common, quite every day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the technique, the only limiting aspect to this technique is the size of the crystal being used. But these crystals can actually be quite big. Some are up to 7 meters tall, which you could easily hide a person behind. However, there are some limitations. To begin with, it only works on 2D. So you have to kind of be standing in front of it for this effect to work.
Okay.
And you can't move to the side. And then there's another one, and this isn't one of the technical ones, but let's pretend they solve the 3D aspect of it. So you have this army cloaked by this crystal moving across the field to attack the enemy. The enemy sits there and say, well, at least there's no army coming at us, but what the hell are all those crystals moving?
Yeah.
You know, it's, I'm going, ugh. But no, apparently the way it works, in the actual scientific paper, they mentioned that they take two sheets of crystal, one polarized one way, one polarized the other, and they put them sort of on top of each other, facing opposite directions, and put it over top of the object, and both the sheet and the clip become invisible.
Hmm.
So maybe it will be an empty field. But I just thought, hey, one, it's interesting cloaking device. B, the headline for this is so overblown, but cool anyhow.
Yeah, well, when it gets that cool cloaking sound from Star Trek, I'll be interested.
I'm sure Jay will mention it on SGU, which
yeah,
they always copy our stories after we do them.
They do, don't they? Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. When we come back, we'll have another Argument Clinic segment tuned up, so stay tuned for that.
Yes, bravo. Yes, indeed.
This is going to make your world
a lot different than the one I grew up in.
You know what?
CITR.
Is? Sure, it's over there.
And over there is where that sound is coming from. Right, Mr. Marconi?
Through the air, across the ocean. The first time ever.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and The Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or visit us online at citr.ca.
Whoever is led to believe that species are mutable will do good service by conscientiously expressing his conviction. For only thus can the load of prejudice by which this subject is overwhelmed be removed.
So what you know about natural selection? Go ahead and ask a question and see where the answer gets you.
BC's own Baba Brinkman is bringing his spoken word rationalist rap to Vancouver in a presentation by CITR and Radio Free Thinker, Vancouver's number one skeptical radio show and podcast. His lyrics have been called sometimes sly, often hilarious, and always smart and thought-provoking. Don't miss Baba Brinkman, the rap guide to evolution, February 20th, 9 p.m. at the Railway Club in Vancouver. For more information, check out www.radiofreethinker.com. Here on Radio Free Thinker, we often talk about things called logical fallacies in terms of argument rhetoric. But if you're not an expert with these terms, this segment is for you. This is Radio Free Thinker Argument Clinic.
Yes, it is. It is. An argument is a collective series of statements to establish a definite proposition.
No, it isn't.
Correlation does not imply causation. Correlation versus causation. What does this mean and why is it important? Two events or actions that occur at the same time are said to correlate. When one event makes another event happen, it is said to have caused the next event. However, some people often confuse the two terms and mistakenly assume that just because two events correlate, they must have a causal relationship. Correlation does not imply causation is a phrase used in science and statistics to emphasize that correlation between two variables does not automatically imply that one causes the other. Correlation proves causation is a logical fallacy by which two events that occur together are claimed to have a cause and effect relationship. The fallacy is also known as cum hoc ergo propter hoc, Latin for with this, therefore, because of this. The cum hoc ergo propter hoc logical fallacy can be expressed as follows. A occurs in correlation with B, therefore A causes B. In this type of logical fallacy, one makes a premature conclusion about causality after observing only a correlation between two or more factors. A mundane example would be eating a sandwich and the mail arriving. Obviously, eating a sandwich doesn't cause the mail to arrive. It is simply a coincidence that the two events occur at the same time. In other words, there can be no conclusion made regarding the existence or direction of a cause and effect relationship, only from the fact that A and B are correlated. Determining whether there is an actual cause and effect relationship requires further investigation. This fallacy is often used to give a statistical correlation a causal interpretation. It is possible that both variables are independent of one another, and it is therefore mere coincidence that they are both increasing at the same time. Consider cell phones and brain cancer. A person who develops brain cancer may also have a cell phone. These two factors correlate, but is there a causal relationship? Does the cell phone cause the cancer? Even in a study where correlation between cell phone use and brain tumors is found, we can only be confident that there is most probably a causal connection. The correlations, however, will give you no clue as to what that causal mechanism might be. Remember, correlation does not imply causation.
This was Radio Free Thinker, Argument Clinic.
Now, let's get one thing quite clear. I most definitely told you.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
You did not.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Didn't.
Yes, I did.
Welcome back to Radio Free Thinker. So, archaeologists, I mentioned that everything they seem to do these days turns into a raging controversy. Well, now the law is putting the kibosh on some of their hard work.
What have you dug up recently, Ethan, on this particular topic? I would hate for you to rebury this issue, but...
One day we're going to do a show that's all puns. So archaeologists are dealing with a new rule that states that they have to rebury their finds. Now, this is causing a lot of trouble because they have recently unearthed a number of human remains at Stonehenge and other ancient settlements. And now they're being required to rebury and potentially lose all the science that they could gain from these discoveries.
Actually, to state it correctly, it's not like there's a new law or rule.
That's true.
The way this had come about is that up until 2008, it was the Home Office, which is like the Secretary of State or Ministry of the Interior, was responsible for archaeological digs and that sort of thing. And it had been transferred over in 2008 to the Ministry of Justice. And the Ministry of Justice looked at the laws, and there's actually two particular laws that were supposed to govern this. One of them is the Burial Act of 1857, and the other is the Disused Burial Grounds Act of 1981. To which the Home Office, with regards to that, sort of said, well, you know, if the remains are a, and I quote, sufficient age, unquote, then they should be relatively exempt from these particular laws. But now that they're under the Ministry of Justice, the Ministry of Justice says, well, you know, we should revisit this, and until we rewrite the laws, we're going to apply these old acts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the laws themselves had nothing to do with archaeology. They had to do with grave robbing and urban expansion.
Well, yeah, the you know, anyone who's ever watched a macabre movie from the 1800s know that, you know, anatomy was becoming a big thing, and medical studies was becoming a big thing in the 19th century, and you needed bodies in order to do dissections and all that. And one of the best places to get your bodies was to go to the local supermarket, or what they called it back then, the graveyard, and you just dig them up, and they'd end up in these things. So they created a law to try and protect the bodies. Now, that was the first set. The second set, in 1981, you had a lot of urban expansion. Cities were growing, they were building suburbs and that. And because England is such an old country, there are a lot of places that were towns or villages and then were abandoned, and they had their own graveyards. And when a place like Manchester expands out, sometimes they were expanding over a deserted burial ground. And some people just said, well, it doesn't seem quite right. You should just be digging it up. And they'd find remains, and they'd find own caskets. And it was just largely for public sensibilities that, mm-hmm. that law came into.
Well, also, apparently a lot of the subway systems that were being built were unearthing corpses. Not like people who've been murdered, but people who were just buried, and I guess they somehow got in the way of the bulldozers. Nevertheless, a letter that's been addressed to the Justice Secretary, Ken Clark, was printed also in the Guardian newspaper, is signed by 40 archaeological professors writing of their deep and widespread concern over this issue. The law on the books now state that all human remains excavated at digs in England and Wales have to be reburied within 2 years, regardless of their age. Even if you unearth a skeleton from the Roman ages, you have to rebury that in 2 years. Which, I mean, you'd think, okay, well, 2 years, they got to be able to do something like that. Well, they can do some science, but I mean, it takes a while just to get the thing out of the ground without breaking it, for one thing. Getting it to a lab to do any kind of studies, and then if you want to put it in a museum or display it to the public, that takes more than 2 years.
Well, and that's another aspect of this too, which isn't mentioned a bit, but one of the other things that they have to do is they also have to hide their fieldwork from the public. And one of the things that's quite big, I've mentioned before on the show here, that one of the shows I love is a show called Time Team, which is an hour-long primetime archaeological show on British television, which I just couldn't see ever happening here. But in a certain degree, those shows wouldn't be able to function properly once they discovered human remains, because they're supposed to be hidden from the public. But that cuts off the public from their very own history. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned another thing, too. I mean, one, you know, you want to put it in a museum for, you know, to display it. But quite often, the scientific techniques that we have today are good, but 10 years from now they're going to be better, and in 30 years they're going to be better. And if you're forced to rebury these, and there's a lot of fuzziness over how they're even reburied, that information, the bones themselves, could actually be literally destroyed. In fact, I have from the British Archaeological Magazine that claims to, and I quote, to be the voice of British archaeology and beyond. I'm not quite sure what was beyond, but they pointed out that there are really three principal reasons why they feel disquieted about this. The first is the fact that it essentially means the destruction of human remains, and it prevents future study. They said that it is the forensic equivalent to book burning and the willful ruining of knowledge, because they're not allowed to keep these in a pristine condition for future examination. They also mentioned, too, that that the reburial isn't always the most ethical option. You know, as you're pointing out, where are you going to bury them? You know, these are pagans, so if you bury them in a Christian cemetery, that's not quite, you know, there's a lot of aspects in that. And the third, as I say, because, you know, they're not allowed to be out in the open, you have to hide these, it essentially does a disservice to the public, who quite often help fund a lot of these excavations, and who should be engaged in science.
Absolutely. The ruling applies to any pieces of bone uncovered at around 400 dig sites, including remains of 60 or so bodies found at Stonehenge in 2008, many of them that date back to 3000 BC. Archaeologists have been granted a temporary extension to give them more time. Ultimately, until these laws are changed, the bones will have to be returned to the ground. So something to keep our eye on in the UK. In the meantime, it turns out that world population growth is also causing concerns. Following up on a news story that we mentioned a couple of weeks ago about the radical changes that food production has to go under to support the world population, a report has been issued to the UN, and it's suggesting that world population growth has to slow down or else, and the or else in this case is, I guess, catastrophic results. To have a reasonable chance of stabilizing world population, fertility must drop below, quote, replacement level. It must be maintained at that level for an extended period, says the report. The world population is already poised to reach 7 billion later this year, and this figure could potentially double to 14 billion by 2100 if action is not taken. The UN Population Division has produced six projections of potential future population change based on different changes to how we continue to reproduce. At the medium scenario, world population would peak at 9.4 billion in 2070. But at sort of the worst scenario, if fertility remains mostly around 2.2 or 2.3 children per woman, this would lead to a world population of nearly 30 billion and 2300, which, I mean, okay, that's 300 years in the future, but, you know, time goes fast, and it takes a while to build those giant spaceships.
Exactly. You know, and one of the things I think is often lost on this is there's two things here. One is, in order for us to stabilize at 9 billion, let's say we make it to 9 billion, we actually have to have at least a, what is it, 2.0 or 2.1 children per family birth rate, which is enough to replace the population but not expand it at all. I mean, even a small growth rate will mean there's going to be more people. It'll take longer for the doubling effect, but you're still going to be taxing the carrying capacity of the planet. And that leads into the other thing. You may or may not have heard on our show before, but we've mentioned things like, oh, climate change, and how that's going to disrupt the way we've done things in the past. A lot of people who say, well, don't worry about population, it will take care of itself. One of the things that maybe they're overlooking is that we're heading for a dramatic reduction in the carrying capacity of the planet, at least in for a short-term period while we adjust, which means that, you know, we have trouble feeding everyone as it is, and I can't see how that's going to get easier, at least in the next 50 to 100 years.
I mean, with more population, you need more food, more medicine, more land, and more resources. All of those things are finite right now. And, you know, the argument is sort of made, I think, sometimes erroneously that, well, if things get bad, we'll have less children. No, we won't. If you look at the countries that have things bad, they have more children. So we're—I mean, it's a scary thought, actually, when you think about it. But you know, I think it's a conversation that needs to start having happening in academic circles and moving beyond that into the public sphere as well.
You know, and one of the things that works against this, one of the reasons why it doesn't become a major issue, everyone says, well, it will take care of itself, because really the only solution to it tends to fall into, one, we need to have dramatically greater equality on the planet, because studies have shown that the better educated, the better fed people are, the less children they will tend to have. Mm-hmm. But we're not quite willing to just say, okay, everyone now has the same wage and the same money. Or the flip side is forcing the issue by doing what China has done, and you create laws which will have their own repercussional issues. So we say, well, in practical terms, we can't do anything about it, so we'll just pretend that there isn't a problem, which is just sticking your head in the sand.
Absolutely. Let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
We like to party, right? Guys like him, they don't like to party like we do. You know, we're having a lot of fun.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We like to party.
Yeah, we like to party. Did I say that already?
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. But I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So, Don, you were mentioning earlier before about the Bible being updated. What's up with that?
Well, apparently the New Catholic Bible is deleting the words booty and Holocaust, a few others. The unerring word of God apparently needs to be revised yet again. So it's just a short note about a pending publication of New Catholic Bible, which apparently is the New American Bible Revised Edition, that's to be released this Ash Wednesday or March 9th for those of you who are not acquainted with the Catholic myth holidays. In this edition, they're following the current trend that we've documented before about altering the text to reflect current sensibilities. So, the word like booty has been replaced with plunder because there are fears that readers may get confused with a part of the human anatomy that we are currently sitting on. It also removed the word Holocaust because it is deemed to be a term referred to exclusively to the Jewish genocide in World War II, which we could get into too, but we'll just let that go. So this is the fourth edition of the New American Bible. Apparently there was no Old American Bible.
Hmm.
When you couple this fact with the fact that there have been at least hundreds, if not millions, of other translations and re-editions of the original, quote-unquote, original Latin Bible, which itself, of course, is the product of multiple revisions and translations. And the Latin Bible, of course, is based upon either the Greek, Hebrew, or Aramaic Bibles before them, which were also copied and edited previously. So why am I making such a big point about this long line of revision and translations? Historically, if less so today, depending on where you live, of course, people believe that it's the perfect, inerrant word of God, as in, this is it, nothing else, no more, ever again, you follow it or else. And they follow it, I mean, say, to the letter, unto death. And if not their own death, someone else's death. And if you think about it, I mean, even if you believed that the Bible originally was the Word of God, okay, I don't go there, but let's pretend, how could you possibly believe the Bible you are currently reading in a church in Ipswich, Massachusetts, or Downswitch, South Carolina, wherever, is the literal word, and you are quite willing to, if not kill people, make their life a living hell based upon the words you're reading in that book, which reflect in probably very little way to the original text, let alone the text in context.
Absolutely. Talk about misconceptions.
Exactly.
And to talk about misconceptions.
Wow, that was almost good.
Yeah, it was, actually. We're going to be talking a bit about now some common misconceptions and where they come from. And, you know, why common misconceptions? Well, for one, they're common, obviously. But perhaps, and most interesting, they fall into that sort of pool of folk wisdom of things that just aren't true. And they're the kind of facts and memes that get repeated at parties and over dinner and, you know, things your grandparents tell you, things you hear on the schoolyard, things repeated in textbooks by lazy writers. They sort of mistakes, but they get told as real facts, and then they get told wrong, and then they sort of enter that realm of myth and legend and get propagated.
So would this be something like what people often refer to as, it's common knowledge? We all know it's true.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason why, you know, this kind of came to my attention, I was actually reading a Wikipedia article about this, and it just really struck me of so many of these things that people, you know, take at face value without doing any sort of research to themselves. And so I pulled up some examples, and I think these kind of illustrate some of the reasons why common misconceptions sort of spread around. And again, I think these are all operate within the realm of, you know, things that skeptics should be pointing out and trying to educate people on, particularly the fact that some of these aren't all related to science as well. Some of these are related to culture and history and other things like that. One that caught my eye is the Iron Maiden.
Don't you dare diss one of my favorite bands of all time.
I knew you were going to say that.
How could you not?
The Iron Maiden, to people who aren't gone, is a torture device. Well, actually, maybe. But it's a torture device that was like a large metal coffin with metal spikes on the inside. The victim was placed inside, and the spikes were driven into their body while they were still standing. The Iron Maiden is commonly believed to be invented in the Middle Ages, and sort of you see it in the background in a lot of period piece movies during the Spanish Inquisition and all these kind of things. In actuality, it was invented in the 18th century. And there's no account of the Iron Maiden that can be found earlier than 1793. So how did this misconception spread? Obviously, popular culture has done its fair share, but also through museums and historic error. According to Wolfgang Schnelled, a professor of criminal law at the University of Bielefeld, any known Iron Maidens that are you see at museums are actually pieced together from several artifacts that they just kind of cobbled together to make it look fancy.
So you mean they're like props?
They're props. So they're things that people found and go, oh, this must be an Iron Maiden. They kind of like jury-rigged it together with like tape and bubblegum or something and put it in the museum to sort of be that sort of awe and shocking, you know, ooh, look at this type stuff. Which is kind of, you know, disappointing because they look kind of cool. One of the most famous devices of Iron Maidens was from Nuremberg, and it was first displayed around 1802. The original was actually lost in Allied bombing of Nuremberg in 1944. However, historians have ascertained that this was, in fact, a hoax. It was created in 1793, and the story was that it was as old as, like, 14-something-something. But it wasn't. The guy who made it propagated it as a hoax. This was, again, going back to a time when these sort of things would travel around almost sort of like carnivals and, you know, roadside attractions type stuff. So again, you sort of had this neat device of torture that sort of entered the popular culture and was kind of popularized, but ultimately has no historical backing whatsoever.
I think it's important, too, to note, I mean, especially in this particular instance, and I won't go too much into that, but, I mean, one of the things about a torture device is to instill fear in the populace. So even if this wasn't a real torture device, but if people thought, oh, if I do something wrong, and it wouldn't be that unusual for people in the 18th or 19th century to think you may actually be subjected to a Iron Maiden, be it fictional or not, has its value. But are you telling me, Ethan, that we can't trust what we see in museums, that science gets things wrong? Is there no kernel of truth in this at all?
Well, there might be. Possibly the inspiration for the Iron Maiden may come from the Carthaginian execution of Marcus Attilus Regulus, as it was recorded in a passage in St. Augustine's City of God, in which the Carthaginians, quote, packed him into a tight wooden box spiked with sharp nails on all sides so that he could not lean in any direction without being pierced. Now, I mean, okay, so that's a possible origin for this Iron Maiden, but again, you'd think that torture over the thousands of years of history, something like this is bound to happen eventually, so I don't put too much credibility into this possible origin of the Iron Maiden.
Well, you know, and I do appreciate the fact that, I mean, at least the science of it, I mean, we know it's a fake now.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's still maybe in popular culture, but not all fakes are kind of accidental, right? I mean, some are actually done for propaganda, especially, you know, if you're trying to diminish, literally, your enemy. Is there any examples for that?
Well, yeah, you're really good at this one. So everyone's heard of Napoleon, right? And what's the thing that everyone talks about with Napoleon? You know, he was this short little guy. He had an inferiority complex and tried to take over the world because of it. This is one that's been repeated over and over and over again. And in reality, Napoleon was not unusually short. He was 5'2" in the French form of measurement, which corresponds to about 5'6" in modern or international standards, or about 1.68 meters tall.
Which would have been quite respectable for that period of time.
Yeah, and still respectable today. I mean, that's not even, I don't think people consider that very short at all. So where did this notion of, like, the literal general come from? And I think the obvious answer is, well, keep in mind that Napoleon was the enemy of a lot of people, and they weren't above making fun of him by describing him as short or small. And now, he was the primary enemy of Great Britain, and so British newspapers would print up, you know, funny pictures of him and, you know, that sort of thing. And we are, I mean, Canada, America, most of the English-speaking world is the English-speaking world because of the British Empire, so it's not surprising that this meme gets spread to us as well. The other interesting thing that I think can come up with this is that if you're not familiar with the transition from French measurements to English measurements, if someone just told you that Napoleon was 5'2", well, that is kind of a little short. But so maybe some people were confused by the fact that the French and the English use different systems of measurements. In addition, his nickname, the Le Petit Corporal, is often confused to mean, like, small. But in French, the phrase Le Petit is a term of endearment. You would call your boyfriend or girlfriend petit ami. It doesn't mean they're small. It just means they're, like, you know, your little friend or something like that. Or it's a, you know, weird thing that they say.
Well, and let's not forget, too, that, I mean, what was one of the characters in Robin Hood, Little John? Was he small? No,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean.
Yeah, exactly, right? And the reason why he had this nickname is, at least according to most people, is that he was very chummy with his troops. He was a kind of, you know, man of the people type guy. He would visit his ordinary soldiers, and this was his representation of his camaraderie with them.
Well, and Napoleon in particular had two or three good things that went for him. I mean, one, he rose up from the ranks. I mean, he was a common soldier in a time when most of the generals and all that came from the aristocracy or came from that. And fortunately for him, unfortunately for Lot, it was the post-revolutionary period where people of ability could suddenly skyrocket into positions that were normally reserved for that. So he was a man of the people, or at least of the troops, and he had that. And second of all, Napoleon was quite famous for saying that an army moves on its stomach. And he was actually took very good care when he could to make sure his troops were well fed. In fact, the area of modern preserves comes from him. It was he set up a contest for someone to say, hey, I want to have, like, you know, steak and kidney pie. Well, I guess him would be something more French than steak and kidney. Sorry about that.
Sure.
A British origin. You know, that could be preserved and sent to the troops, and it would taste just as good there as it's not. And actually, a French inventor invented sort of preserves where they put all the gooks into a champagne bottle and sterilized it like we would do now. Pasteurized is a term.
Right.
Right? And send it off to the troops. And so him caring about his troops was another huge thing. And let's not forget that under his rule, France controlled basically all of Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, to sit there and say that he was loved by his people, at least for a significant part of his reign, is not that hard to see.
Exactly. I mean, the sort of the joke about Napoleon is that he brought freedom and liberty at the point of a gun to most of Europe. You mentioned how his soldiers were like well fed. That was one of the reasons he was so successful, is because his soldiers actually were taken care of, as opposed to the enemy soldiers who were like starving and didn't really care that much about the army they were fighting for. So, I mean, here you see kind of a misconception that's perpetuated by, you know, an insult, really, British insult, catching on in the English-speaking world. Why not?
Right. But of course, I mean, we've talked about small things, right? I mean, there's nothing on a global scale that could be so misinterpreted, could there be?
You're getting too good at this. So another myth that I actually find quite irksome is the myth of the flat Earth and the conception that people in the Middle Ages thought the world was flat instead of spherical. This is, in fact, a myth. Very few people of educated means thought that the Earth was flat during the Middle Ages. This idea seems to have been widespread in the first half of the 20th century, so much so that members of the Historical Association, I'm not sure which one that would be, but one of them, issued a statement, probably the British one, the idea that educated men at the time of Columbus believed that the Earth was flat, and that this belief was one of the obstacles to be overcome by Columbus before he could get his project sanctioned, remains one of the hardiest errors in teaching. During the early Middle Ages, virtually all scholars maintained that the spherical viewpoint, first expressed by the ancient Greeks by the 14th century, belief in a flat Earth among the educated was essentially dead. So, this kind of ties into the whole Dark Ages myth as well. They weren't all that dark in terms of education. A lot of the ancient knowledge of the Romans and the Greeks did survive, and really, at no point did anyone seriously think that the Earth was flat. Perhaps part of this comes from the notion of the Catholic Church imposing strict penalties on people like Galileo. But one of the things that people kind of overlook is that Galileo was kind of a jerk and liked to make fun of people. And he was pretty eager to make fun of the Catholic Church. So a lot of times the reaction was being provoked by people who were just kind of, you know, flipping their nose at the establishment.
Well, and also, too, and I hate to help the Catholic Church in any way, but the Catholic Church at the time was kind of accommodationalist in it, is that it understood that there were sort of practical realities to the world. So Copernicus's sun-centric universe, they were quite willing to say, listen, if it works, it's great, just don't make theological claims about it. Mm-hmm. And that's where Copernicus came into. Copernicus says, no, this is the real, real truth and not just a useful explanation for things. Anyone at the time who was involved in navigation, who were sailors at the time, knew the Earth was roundish, because if you ever see a ship sailing off into the horizon, it literally disappears beyond the horizon, and it
Absolutely.
Doesn't take a total dinghy not to notice why.
Yeah, and you mentioned sort of the thing with the Catholic Church. One of the reasons people assume that this myth was perpetuated was that during the 17th century, many Protestants were trying to write tracts that said that the Catholics were kind of dumb and stupid. And one of them sort of gained traction was this whole notion of the flat Earth. Historian James Hannum believes that this is particularly perpetuated by a number of false histories that were created by someone like John William Draper in his History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science in 1874, and Andrew Dickinson White's History of the Welfare of Science with Theology and Christendom in 1896. And these are largely false histories, and many believe that they were motivated by a political, ideological, or religious view to sort of tarnish the Catholic Church. And, you know, as you all know, there are lots of reasons to tarnish the Catholic Church. You don't need to make things up. There's another, I think, source for this myth is that a lot of the artwork that originated in the medieval times sort of depicts the Earth as flat. And, of course, this, I think, assumes then that all the artists of the time were constantly being literal, which is so kind of ridiculous, I think.
Well, and also you get the idea, too, that if you were a sailor and you ran into a storm out in sea or your navigation went off or whatever, right, and you never returned, people would sit there and say, in a colloquial sort of sense, he's fallen off of the earth.
Yeah.
Not necessarily meaning that in a literal term, but just he has gone and he's never going to come back.
People still
right?
use that expression all the time. You talk about a friend you haven't heard from in 5 years. Oh, he fell off the earth.
Yeah.
You know, you don't literally mean he, whoa, but... Yeah, he's disappeared. What I think really bothers me particularly about this is that it's been perpetuated by textbooks, both of science and history, and just people not being very critical, reprinting this myth for the sake of having something, some filler in your textbook, which is very frustrating. Why don't, before we go on, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll all recharge our batteries and come back after this.
Theater at UBC presents the world premiere of Double Double Foil and Fumble, a farcical, intelligent whirlwind play written by MFA candidate Ren Hanman and directed by Hersey Innit. Double Double Foil and Fumble follows the story of five friends who get together to weave some magic, only none of them know what they're doing, half of them don't believe in magic, and some of them have ulterior motives. Add in some gender-bending reality shifts and you've got yourself a fabulous evening in the theater. Admission is by donation, with all proceeds going to Positive Space at UBC. Double Double Foil and Fumble plays February 9th to the 12th in Dorothy Somerset Studio on UBC campus. Showtime is 7:30 p.m., 6:30 on February 11th.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. And we're talking about common misconceptions, and we were talking about some sort of historic ones.
And really, quite frankly, those are old and boring. What about, you know, in my current everyday life now, is there any common misconceptions that can actually, I don't know, maybe even endanger my life, or at least are something I should be aware of that might be a hazard?
Well, I'm sure there are. For example, if you're ever face-to-face with an ostrich, don't try to scare it so that it puts its head under the ground. They won't do that. They don't do that. That's another common misconception, that ostriches will bury their heads in the sand.
Well, what about the idea then that, you know, there's been this big die-off in bees? Well, we know why there's been a big die-off in bees, is that they've been crashing to the ground because they're not aerodynamic. They can't possibly really fly.
Yes, the creationist argument that bees were designed because they're not aerodynamic. I think we've actually mentioned this on the show before. Bees fly sort of like a helicopter does, but this is another common misconception promoted by an ideological viewpoint to try to dissuade people from believing in evolution.
There's actually another one I'm going to point out. If anyone goes to a website called Crooks and Liars, they've got some video about Bill O'Reilly, who was talking about the tides. And he
yeah.
says, the tides go in, the tides go out, perfect all the time, has to be God.
Yeah.
You know, I just oh. hurt my brain.
Bill O'Reilly is
why does the Earth have a moon and Mars doesn't? I mean, you tell me that. He says.
Yeah.
Of course.
Well, go to like grade 5 science class and I'm sure he'll learn a thing or two. So another one that pops up a lot for skeptics is the notion that sharks don't get cancer. They do in fact get cancer, and this misconception was invented by a fellow named William Lane in his book Sharks Don't Get Cancer, so that he could sell shark cartilage as a bogus cure for cancer. And this was actually quite recent. This was like in the early 90s, I believe. And this still sticks around. I hear this all the time. And it's so ridiculous.
Well, you see that's where our modern, you know, multimedia sort of society kind of works against itself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you will hear about this sharks don't get cancer from one source, but you don't actually ever hear the, oh, by the way, this guy was just trying to scam and make a lot of money off of stupid people.
Yeah.
So you get the one message, but you don't get the other message.
Exactly.
Whatever is a skeptic to do in such a situation?
Well, you know, I would say that it's a skeptic's duty to try to point out these mistakes when you see them. You know, this kind of gets into the whole question of how confrontational you want to be. Do you want to embarrass the person? Do you want to, you know, make yourself sound like a know-it-all? But I think you don't have to do those kind of things. You can say things in a way that doesn't insult somebody's intelligence when you correct them on a mistake like this. Part of the willingness, or part of the reason that misconceptions spread, is a willingness to take anecdotal evidence as evidence. And if we don't sort of ask people when they say things like this, well, where's your evidence for this? Where's your proof? Where's your source? they're going to keep doing it. And, you know, as they say, as all skeptics realize, when you don't stand up to pseudoscience, it spreads and it hurts people. So another reason for skeptics everywhere to, hey, that's wrong, sharks do get cancer.
You know, and if anyone's ever listened to me in a private conversation, I will quite often caveat my thing that I believe this to be relatively true, but you should check it out. Because one thing about being a skeptic is, you know, you don't take everything at face value. You be a little skeptic. Now, if someone came up to me and said, well, you know, medieval people believed in the flat earth, I'd go, well, that doesn't really affect my life today, so I'm not going to rush out and do a lot of research on that soon, but I'll keep that in my mind and maybe I'll find something different. But if someone says, oh, you've got cancer, don't go see the doctor. Go have some shark cartilage. I'm sure that will cure it because I heard about it in a book. I'd go, well, that might actually cause me some harm if I don't check it out. Yeah. So I'm going to just check it out and see if it's true. So one thing is to try and confront misconceptions when you see it. But another one is to be aware that you may be the repository of those misconceptions and things you believe. You should be willing to go out and at least challenge, check yourself out a bit, you know.
Well, it's all about proportioning your skepticism to the sort of amazing level of the claim. If somebody says, you know, I'm making some coffee, you can be like, what? I demand to see some evidence. It's kind of a mundane thing. If they say, I have a dragon in my garage, you know, that's a bit more extreme, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So yeah, the final point, I think, to make on conceptions and misconceptions here is that, again, sometimes they're actually perpetuated by positions of authority. So newspapers, books, textbooks, we've talked about this before on the show. It's very important to call these authorities out when they make mistakes like this. And, you know, we've sort of been a running theme on this show that newspapers and journalism is great for politics and social issues when there's two sides to an issue. When it comes to science or matters of fact, there usually isn't two sides. So it's very important, I think, for skeptics to be very proactive in pointing out the errors that they see in their newspapers, in their books, in their textbooks, in the classroom as well.
Well put.
Absolutely. And we're out of time here on Radio Freethinker. How about that? Why don't we go to our skeptical highlights?
I've got two and Ethan has one. I'm going to do one, then Ethan can do one, then I can do one.
Sounds good.
Okay, my first one is there's a panel discussion coming out called When Students Speak Up for Palestinians' Rights, which is going to be held at the UBC sub, room 207/209, on February 11th at 5:30 to 8 p.m. There's free pizza and speakers from across the country. They're going to be talking about the issues of free speech and how some people feel that those rights are being diminished because of things that they are saying. Ethan?
Alrighty then. Let's see. On February 20th, 9 p.m., Baba Brinkman, the skeptical rapper, is bringing his Rap Guide to Evolution to Vancouver. Presented by Radio Free Thinker, CITR, and CFI Vancouver. We're having him as a guest at the Railway Club, 9 p.m. Tickets are $8 at the door. And the evening will also feature the band Aaron Nasrul and the Boom Boom. Sounds exciting, does it not?
Exactly. And I'm just giving a pre-shout-out about a march that's going to be held for International Day of Elimination of Racism, which anyone knows about our last topic we did, is science a form of imperialism? Kind of relates to that. That's going to be on March 20th at 11 p.m. Starts at Waterfront Station. More on that in the future.
Excellent. Well, we're pretty much out of time, so let's remind our listeners, if you like the show, if you want us to answer any questions, you have any topic suggestions, email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Be sure to swing by our webpage, www.radiofreethinker.com, to check out all the blogs and show notes for all the stuff that we talk about here. And if you're on Twitter, you should find us on Twitter at CITRRFT. And I think that's all our social networking circles that we've just covered. Of course, we do have a podcast. If you like the show, you just caught the tail end of it and you want to hear the first half, go on iTunes, subscribe to Radio Free Thinker, and there you're all set.
And don't forget to dig us on Dig.
That's right. We're on Dig, too. Dig us on Dig. Yes. Well, folks, my name is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
See you next week, folks.
Bye-bye.